Yeah, we're rolling.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast special. Ooh. I'm excited. This is where we ask a question and we get an expert to tell us the answer. Today's question, why is my memory so bad? Answering the question is Dr. Julia Shaw. She has written a book called The Memory Illusion, Remembering, Forgetting, and the Science of False Memories. She actually believes you can change your memories. I think so. It's worth staying tuned for this. I have some memories I'd like to get rid of. How's your memory, Mark?
It's all right, actually. It's all right.
Is it?
Yeah, it's not perfect. It's not photographic in any way, or whatever that term is.
Oh, we'll ask about that.
Yeah.
I think she thinks photographic memories don't exist, so we'll ask about that. I struggle with names, mainly.
Right. You've got hers. You've just remembered hers.
It's written down.
Right.
I've got a book in front of me. A book's really interesting, actually. Fascinating. So much stuff about the memory. I'll leave it for the interview, though. I also struggle with all the history and dates, especially, you know, football stuff. You know, if you want to be a football fan, you have to have like an encyclopedic knowledge, especially if you're a Liverpool fan. You have to know absolutely everything about, you know, their team and the results. But, you know, you do have to know everything about football. And I can't remember a result. I was told once that the reason I don't remember things is I don't care. I suppose in truth, I do have more important things to do to remember how Chelsea got on against West Brom two seasons ago. But, you know, it's one of those things.
Actually, I think you'll find you didn't play them two seasons ago, Tim. You probably did.
Anyway, Dr. Julia Shaw is going to be on in just a minute of time. But a little bit of other business. We had a couple of emails in, firstly, off the back of Monday's podcast, which I enjoyed doing a lot. It was the one where I was very tired, wasn't it, Mark, after doing the teenage
You were very tired. How are you feeling now?
Very tired, Mark. I seem to spend all of my life tired at the moment. I've got to do something about this. I need some sleep time. Right, this one comes. Dear Lovejoy, it's Janine again with an R again. Now, if anyone remembers last week's podcast, I mispronounced Janine's name. I couldn't get my head around it at all. It had two N's in the middle of it, and I just think, I don't know, it put me off. Anyway, she said, I have a problem. I need advice on. No one ever gets my name right. I was supposed to be named Zoe, but then I ended up being named after a David Bowie track, Janine. That's with one N, though. Even my parents spelled it different, and I ended up with too many N's. Janine. She spells it J-A-N-N-I-N-E. A lifetime misspelling, Janine, J-A-N-E-E-N, etc., etc. She's got four or five different examples. A lifetime of being misheard on the phone, Jenny, Jillian, Janie. And now being misread by someone very tired. That was me on the last podcast. Podcast 10, by the way, is my favourite. Please don't delete it. Oh, and when do I get my certificate? Mark, they're all moaning about certificates.
Well, the first batch have gone out.
Oh,
yes.
Have we done it?
Janine's is on the second batch. I actually did that this morning, so we're going to sign those because we actually have to sign them.
Should we
tell them what we're doing?
Yeah, go on.
Well, we make them to a great expense, and then we print them out, and then we sign them, and then we scan them back again, so you get like Tim's proper signature.
There you go. And then you can print them out, and you can do whatever you want with them once you've printed them out. Laminate them, stick them up on the fridge, frame them, stick them in your main room above the telly to remind yourself that your email was read out on the Deal After Your podcast. Now, going back to names, Mark.
Yeah.
There's that famous Buddhist proverb, your name says more about your parents than you. And I think this is strictly true, you know. It does. And when you're naming a child, you don't think that child... When you look at a child and it's named... think of a bizarre name. I think of a name, Mark. I can't.
What a bizarre one!
Yeah, say it's a little.
Moon unit.
Moon unit. That says everything about the parent, nothing about the child. So you have to be really careful what you're doing when you're naming your children, because it's not fair to give them ridiculous names. But my parents obviously named me Timothy, and that was shortened to Tim. But I don't think there's been any Timothys for a while, has there? I mean, like, what do you reckon?
I haven't seen anyone call their kids Tim. Recently.
It's 20 years ago. Tim's not a great name, is it? Now, I've got to tell you this story. There was, what's his name? Will Self wrote an article. I mean, I always assumed Will Self was a really bright, intelligent man. He wrote an article about why the name Tim is so bad. And I don't know, the Sun or one of the tabloids phoned me up and said, do you want to reply to this? And I went, absolutely not. It's a name.
Yeah.
It's the most ridiculous, like... I said, just phone Will Self up and say, have you run out of material, mate? This is absolutely ludicrous. If you Google it, it's like, why Tim is a bad name? It's such a stupid thing.
Not having him on as a guest then?
We can have him on as a guest. We can actually, why don't we get him on and say, why do you think Tim's a bad name? He'll go, that's how he talks now, don't he? But I still quite like him. Mark, no one calls their kids Mark anymore, do they?
The world is a worse place for it, I would say.
I worked with a guy, this must have been 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago. He had a baby boy and he called him Alan after Alan Shearer.
Not all the other Alans. Partridge.
But it's like, you know, you wouldn't call your kid Tim at the moment. You wouldn't call your kid Mark. You wouldn't call your kid Alan, would you? Actually, he'll stand up.
Baby Alan.
When he said Alan, his other kid was called Jackie after Jackie Milburn. But why? I was just like, this is ridiculous. And I said to him, I think that's a mad name. But he loved it, Alan. So he's got little Alan. And I also had a friend who called his son, this is the truth, he called his son Elvis. And I don't think you can call your son Elvis. I think Elvis owns Elvis. And I don't think anyone can call their son Elvis. Anyway, when I saw him, it was a long time I saw him. It was about 2 months after. And I went, hey, Ed, how are you doing? And he went, yeah, fine. He goes, don't talk to me about the name. And he said, I'm just sick of it. I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to do it. And so, you know, that is the case that you have to spend the whole of your life going, explaining why you called your son Elvis. A friend of mine's put Elvis as a middle name just recently. And I suppose a middle name works. But Elvis owns his name, doesn't he?
Does he? Oh, yeah. I thought you meant like a TM.
No.
Elvis Costello is pretty cool as well.
Yeah, actually, yeah, you're right.
So,
yeah, all
right. I think because Liam Gallagher called his son Lennon. Lennon Gallagher is a very cool name. I love that name.
Yeah, but the kid has to carry it around with him.
He does. He carries it very well. Have you seen him?
No, but do you think when
he already looks like a rock star? He's going to.
Yeah, but do you think we'd like? And you're saying that's a good thing. I've not met many happy rock stars. So what are you doing? You're saying you're going to give your child this name that he has to carry around with him and. You know. Hey, look at my new son. He's called Jed Skywalker or something. You're like, what is that kid going to be?
Jed Skywalker.
I don't know. It's like, what the hell is he going to be?
Half remembered Star Wars. Jed Skywalker.
As a parent, you have to be responsible and give your kids normal names, don't you think?
Like Tim.
Yeah, like Tim. Timothy, yeah. Right, I've got another email here. This one's from our good old mate, actually. We're creating a little community here, which is nice. This is from TW, who wrote in, I think, if you remember, he wrote in about...
But you have to be careful how you read this one.
Do I?
Well, you can't give away most of the information in it, because he doesn't want the information to be known.
Oh, doesn't he? Where does it say that? I don't think it says
Show me which one you're going to read.
this is going well.
No, that's not that one.
Right, so this one comes in and he said, as I say, apologies for that, Mark panicking there. Well, I want to know what this email is, the one that I can't read. I've not read that one. Anyway, we're creating a little bit of a community. People like joining in, and that's what we really want you to do is join in on this. And this one comes from TW. Says, I literally just pulled your podcast to email in reference to Viney's issues with his mum passing. I just wanted to say you dealt with it very well. My mum also passed of cancer in October 2015 at the age of 62, and it blew my world apart. I didn't cope well, and all turned to drinking far too much and eating rubbish, generally not looking after myself at all. But then a sudden realization how my mum used to live. She lived her life by one rule: don't worry about the things you can't control. I think his mum probably was a Buddhist.
Yeah,
that sounds like a Buddhist proverb.
She was very wise. Yeah.
Anyway, it hit him, and then he decided to get into cooking, which, if you remember the podcast from a few weeks ago when we read his mail out, he started cooking. Send us pictures. They look lovely. So, you know, it's one of those things. He does go on to say, I hate the cliche, time is a healer, but it really does work. The pain will never leave us, but we understand how to deal with it better. That is very true. The pain is still there, but you just learn how to live with it a bit. I don't know whether the pain subsides and you don't think about it as much. Actually, it's probably a good question to ask Dr. Julia.
Yeah.
What happens? Because, you know, I used to think about my brother every single day, as I mentioned on last week's podcast. And then it's just subsided. And I wonder if that's what happens there with your memory, why it slowly starts going away. And actually, the memory changes. So I used to remember him on his deathbed, and now I don't. I always remember him alive and happy. Anyway, we want to speak to him. So we're going to have a chat with Dr. Julie in just a minute's time. We love your feedback. Please keep sending it in. DearLovejoyPodcast@gmail.com, or you can always tweet me at Tim Lovejoy on Twitter. Shall we meet Julia Shaw then? Dr. Julia Shaw?
Let's do it.
Cue the theme tune.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, Dr. Julia Shaw. How are you?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Well, let's start at the beginning. First of all, tell us what your job is.
I am a memory hacker. I'm a memory scientist. So I convince people that they did things that never happened.
Oh, what is that? Like who? Who are you convincing that to?
I convince participants mostly, but I apply the science of memory to helping, for example, law enforcement better interrogate defendants, to understanding eyewitnesses, to ideally preventing innocent people from going to jail.
So there's a purpose to your science.
There is a purpose. I don't just want to mess with people's sense of reality.
But you're going in and trying to mess with people's sense of reality to work out how it can be better used by crime.
Not by crime.
Solving crime, maybe.
Solving crime, exactly. Preventing crime. And in understanding memory, I think we can understand ourselves better, and we can do our jobs better, and justice can be served better.
Okay, before we get into that, you've got a book out, The Memory Illusion, Remembering, Forgetting, and the Science of False Memory. How would you describe your book? I like it, by the way. Good read.
Thanks. I would describe it as a how-to guide for memory for your brain. It's sort of a best hits of memory science. You get to see some really fun experiments. I talk a lot about science, about the actual studies, and I think it shows you how fallible, how slippery memory is.
Okay, let's start then with what is a memory?
Ooh, a memory. My favorite quote for this actually comes from someone called Elizabeth Loftus, who's sort of who's my idol, my hero. And she says that memory is like a Wikipedia page. It's constructive, it's reconstructive. You can go in there and change it, and so can other people. And I really like this concept of memory as something that is flexible. So we sometimes say that people think that memory's, you know, like a video camera. People don't really think that. They think that memory is somewhat permanent, but they know that it can be lost. They know we can forget things, maybe misremember stuff. But I think when we realize just how flexible it is and how many social processes can go in there and interfere with how we remember, I think that's when we really get to know ourselves.
Who is she? Who's this woman?
Beth?
Your hero? Yeah.
My hero. She works at UC Irvine, University of California, Irvine. And she's essentially established the field of false memory science, especially for courts. And she is an incredibly just wonderful person.
Why did you get into this in the first place?
Because I like to challenge notions of reality. So for one, I've always wondered sort of what is real? Who am I? And I talk about this a bit in the book, where I talk about sort of, you know, when I was a kid. This is actually true. So I recently found diaries that I apparently used to keep as a kid, some journals. And I used to write this stuff down. And even then, I didn't write about, oh, and then I did this, and then I did that. Yeah. I'd write about, like, what is love?
and?
You know, big picture concepts. And so these have always fascinated me. And memory is our reality, what we think happened. And if you can mess with that, you can mess with
everything. Oh, so you're saying we are our memory?
I think your identity is your memory. I think that if you think back, who are you? Who am I?
So the Buddhists say, and I'm big on Buddhism on this, as people know with my Buddhist proverbs, but the Buddhists say if you look into the past, you know, you can suffer depression. If you look into the future, you can suffer from anxiety. Just live for the now. And I suppose if you delve too much into your memory, you're going to get depression.
I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think some of our memories are beautiful.
You can't argue with a Buddhist, Dr. Julia.
I think that you can. I agree with the sentiment that we should live in the present. And I think that that is very much something that I embrace. And the book ends on that kind of positive note of saying, you know, this is very freeing to think, actually, maybe we can't and shouldn't trust our memories. But that's okay, because it really does say now is the closest thing you can get to ever sensing reality.
Okay. Just so people are listening and get a picture of you and who you actually are, just because I think this interview's going to go on quite a long time because we've got some really interesting stuff. You've obviously got an accent. Tell us where you're from.
I'm half Canadian, that's why I sound like this, yeah. And half German.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in both, half and half.
Oh, how did you do that?
Well, I literally, between the ages of 6 and 12, spent 1 month in Germany, 1 month in Canada. 1 month in Germany, 1 month in Canada. I went back and forth and back and forth.
Why? What? Yeah, yeah. Hold on. Why? What happened?
What happened? My dad, being Canadian, lived in Canada, and my mom had a business in Germany, and so I would fly back and forth. Sometimes as an unaccompanied minor was the term.
What? Hold on. They weren't together?
They were together for most of that.
And you went backwards and forwards a month at a time.
Yeah, but my mom would come with me or my dad would come with me. Sometimes I go on my own. I had to go to alternative schooling. So I went
you were asking big questions.
10 different schools and it was just all over the place.
Do you have any friends from when you were a kid?
I do, but perhaps unsurprisingly, they're not location dependent. So they're people I met outside of school. They're people I met at camp or through friends.
So where do you feel you're from?
Citizen of the world is such a terrible cliche term.
But that's what you are. And you live now over here.
I do.
Full-time.
Now I feel like a Londoner. I definitely feel like
so it must be really bizarre for you, the whole Brexit thing recently, seeing that happen.
Yeah.
Should we not get in that?
I don't like that's
what about. All right. So that's it. So you educated where in the end? Where did you end up getting your education to do
this? I got my PhD in Canada.
Right. Okay. So. And then how long have you been over here now for?
I've been over here for 4 years.
And how are we in this science? Are we good, Britain?
Yes. Britain is great.
Are we leading the field?
Yes, in many ways we are. I mean, false memory research, there's some coming out of Canada, some coming out of the States, a lot coming out of the UK.
So who's funding you to do this? Is it our police force?
The people.
The people.
I mean, of course, science grants do often come from the government. So some of my grants have come from the government. But yeah, I mean, I also do work with police and military, and they don't fund me, but they give me access to their people.
And are people taking it seriously? The idea that you're saying sometimes these witnesses believe what they're saying, which we'll probably get to later, but it's not true.
Absolutely.
They're starting to believe that.
Yeah, and I mean, in your own life, you can think about sort of, you know, Aunt Alma telling a story at the dinner table and you're going, that's totally made up. That can't be true. But you can see that your aunt is telling it with such conviction that she clearly believes this story, even though it's demonstrably untrue. And I think everybody can relate to it.
So you talk about that as an old person, but I know some young people who are compulsive liars, but I genuinely believe they believe the truth that they've invented. Can that happen?
Yeah, well, and at that point, it's no longer lying. So I also disagree with the term self-deception because I think if you know that you're lying, you can't lie to yourself effectively. Misremember, so you can just get it wrong.
Okay. All right. Can I take you back a few stages? I said to you, what is memory? What actually is happening when you remember something? Because someone told me once that your body is, there's no part of your body that's over 9 years old. So how can you remember something 15 years ago? What actually is happening when you remember something?
Your brain is so amazing. So I'm not a neuroscientist, although I've dabbled in neuroscience. And actually the chapter I write, I say you can skip over this if you're not into the bio. But in terms of what's happening in the brain, your brain is constantly changing. And so I think people sometimes talk about neuroplasticity as this sort of exclusive, exciting thing. Obviously, your brain is flexible. That's why from the beginning of the sentence to the end of the sentence, you can remember the beginning because something has changed in your brain. And why you can be human at all. So be creative, be intelligent, problem solve. These are all things that are constantly changing the structure of your brain. So anything you do contributes to neuroplasticity. And memories are no exception. So memories make a network in the brain of brain cells. And this network is actually, every time you recall this memory, is actually pulled up and it's changed a little bit. And then sometimes it's put back down. Sometimes it's not. And then we forget stuff. Sometimes we connect things that weren't originally connected. And that's called having a false memory or misremembering. And so this network of brain cells is this incredibly sort of plastic space that's changing all the time.
What's it look like?
What does it look like?
I'm trying to visualize it.
Think of it as a spider web. Okay, that's your memory. That's a memory.
Dumb it down for me, Dr. Julia.
So this network, it looks kind of like a spider web, you could say. And it's distributed across your brain. So that's why when you especially remember parts of your life, autobiographical memories. Mm. You remember what it tasted like. You remember what it smelled like, what it felt like. It's because all those different parts of your brain are being activated as part of this network.
One of my daughters told me that when you remember something, you're remembering the last time you remembered it. Mm-hmm. So it's like photocopying a photocopy continually.
Yeah, or like the terrible term here, Chinese whispers.
Oh, you're not allowed to use that
anymore. Don't like that term. Telephone is what we call it in Canada.
Yeah, it's apparently not on PC anymore to use Chinese whispers.
I would understand why.
Yeah, so how telephone?
Telephone.
Is it?
Yeah, okay. So and the idea that it can... So in this game, just like in your memories, at the end, you can end up with a version that's quite similar to the first story. You know, you whispered in your neighbor's ear, but it can also be dramatically different. And she's absolutely right.
You say memory is false in your book, more or less. What does that mean?
I say memory is an illusion. I go further.
Okay. What does that mean?
It means that we think that our memories are reliable records of the past, but really they are influenced by perceptual biases, sort of what we notice in the moment. They're influenced by our expectations, and they're influenced by how we remember and in what situations we remember them later.
Okay. Why can't I remember names?
Let's say you're paying attention to too many things when you're meeting somebody. So one reason why we might not remember names is because, especially the first instance, you see someone for the first time, you're checking out way too much. You're trying to take in what they look like, what they're doing, are they a threat or not? You're distracted, essentially. And so you're not even really thinking about laying down this name. If you are trying to remember the names, you're repeating it over and over and over again, you might just be using bad strategies to remember it.
No, I'm actually not. You're basically saying I'm very bright. So I'm meeting someone and I'm going, hey, I'm taking all the information. No, she is saying that, Mark.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I'm not just taking the name. I'm taking everything, looking at it. That could be right. Is it true that you only remember things you care about? Someone told me that once, that the reason why I can't remember things, a lot of things, is because I just don't care about them. If I cared about them, I'd remember them. Is that true? Or
that's partially true. I mean, we are inclined to remember things that we care about more, of course. Partly because we're paying more attention to them, we're spending more time with that information, and so it has more potential to become a memory.
If I was to remember something, say I was going to remember this conversation in tomorrow, how much of it would be reality as a percentage and how much of it would be me making it up, do you think?
I can't give you the answer to that, but for one, I know that you're going to forget most of it. Just like most of your life, you do not remember. You don't remember all the nuances. You don't remember what people were wearing in most of your memories. You don't remember what the weather was like necessarily, what time it was exactly. We remember things as what we call in memory science as gist traces. So we often remember the gist of what happened. You know, you talked to someone about memory. You know that she was Canadian. She had a weird accent. And then she had this weird childhood growing up. But you don't necessarily remember verbatim, which is the other type of memory restore, exactly what I said. But you remember the take-home message, and that's usually all you need to remember.
So what? Okay, so when somebody's telling you, I've got a great memory, is that a lie then? They're saying that they just believe that they've got a perception of themselves having a great memory.
There are individual differences. So some people do remember way more than other people. So there's these magical people called HSAMs, highly superior autobiographical memory individuals. And these are the kinds of people who you can ask, you know, what did you do on February 15th, 1987? What did you have for breakfast? And they'll say, oh, yeah, I had eggs. And they're accurate. And you can go back through their journals and just randomly open to a page and say, what did you do on this day, and compare. And these are exceptional rememberers. But even they make mistakes. Even they forget things. And for the average person who says, I'm exceptional at remembering stuff, it might well be a case of overconfidence.
Are we all on a spectrum of memory?
Like, we are.
Some people remember a lot and some people remember hardly. Or are we all pretty much in the middle somewhere?
I mean, like anything, there's a curve usually, right, where it sort of bunches around the middle. But it's more about also what you're good at remembering. So I'm good at remembering concepts. I'm not good at remembering names. Other people are good at remembering what I was wearing, or specifics of situations, or things that interest them, right? And other people, and I'm really good at remembering spatial, like, patterns. Other people are better at remembering the details of a story. So we all have different capacities in terms of what we're good at remembering.
I wonder what I'm good at remembering. I'm not actually sure I'm good at remembering anything, if I'm honest with you. What are the benefits then for you to learning how the memory works? Can you use it in a therapy way? Are you a therapist, Dr. Julia?
I am not a therapist, and I would not like to be one. But I'm very, I think it's very important that there are therapists, and they definitely work with memory. I mean, almost all therapy in some way works with memory, some more directly than others. So let's say you've got PTSD. You've got someone coming in with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
They're saying, I'm having these flashbacks. Please, can you get rid of them? Now, a therapist of various types, doesn't whatever your orientation is in terms of therapy, will probably try to change those memories, or at least your experience of those memories in some way. So some might say, okay, let's make it less anxiety, less arousing. Let's deal with the emotional piece. Let's go over and over again until you're desensitized. Other people might say, okay, well, let's try and erase it, or let's get you to remember it differently. So it's about changing the memory quite often, and most therapies do work with that.
Which one works out of those?
Which kind of therapy?
Yeah, well, should you go over and over and over again to desensitize it, or should you try and change the perception of it? Which one works better? I'm asking for a friend.
I think reconceptualizing our memories can be effective. So I think that if you go into therapy and think, okay, well, what have I... So, okay, let me take it a step back first, yeah. Especially for traumatic experiences. One thing that I think is really important to hammer home is that there is no such thing as a traumatic event. There's only a traumatic interpretation of an event. So let's say there's a car crash.
Yeah.
Now, about 30% of people who are part of this car crash or who have the same car crash will come out of it with post-traumatic stress disorder. And they'll be, you see that my life is negatively impacted. 30%-ish will say, actually, it was just a car crash. It's fine, really. And then 30%, and this is what I think surprises most people, will say, actually, I've experienced post-traumatic growth. Which means that they say that they're happier after the accident than they were before.
So I know one person who was in a, I'm not going to say which, what there were, one person in a major tragedy where lots of people died,
mm-hmm.
and he pulled some people out and rescued them, but mm-hmm. was really absolutely miserable about it,
mm-hmm.
and suffered very badly. Mm-hmm. And, then I know another person who was involved in another tragedy, but he was pulling people out of the water,
mm-hmm.
both water-based, and he said afterwards he felt like a hero,
mm-hmm.
and it changed the way he felt about life.
Exactly.
So that's exactly what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Two different events, totally, by the way, totally. But similar in the way they worked. A lot of people died, and they were both heroes, but one suffered badly and one suffered amazingly.
Exactly. So, and this is where I generally say, don't make people think that just because they've experienced something that's objectively bad, that they need to be suffering, that they need to be having these flashbacks, that they need to, quote, be dealing with it, because everyone deals with things in different ways.
But you actually say you can change your memory, though, don't you? I've heard you say it, and I've read it in interviews, and you say it in your book, that you can actually change the way you perceive things, which have gone into your head.
Mm-hmm.
So give an example of that. What sort of things can you change? So say you've had if you'd had a horrible breakup with someone and you were miserable,
mm-hmm.
could you change it so that you're really happy now because of that happening or something? Or could you?
Well, I mean, we do. I mean, looking back on our lives, I mean, relationships are a great example. Quite often you'll think back longingly, potentially, over a relationship, go, oh my God, actually, it was so amazing. And then you want to be back in that relationship. But what you're doing is you're picking, you know, cherry picking all the wonderful moments and just choosing to remember those and maybe forgetting the reasons why you broke up in the first place. Alternatively, you might go, actually, it must have been terrible. And now if I look back, I'm so thankful that I'm not in that relationship anymore. So, I mean, and obviously there are things in between, but we do have a filter through which we view our lives. And every time we remember things, we do remember them a bit differently.
But how do you change that perception? So you're looking back at the relationship. Say you're looking back at the relationship and going, oh, it's wonderful. I'd like to be mm-hmm. back in there. But then there's a bit of you going, hold on a second. Well, I'm not in that relationship for a reason. How do you change that perception? So when it comes back, you change the memory to go, I don't like that. I didn't.
Yeah, so I mean, it's called metacognition when we think about our thinking. So why am I thinking this way would be the question you want to ask yourself. So why am I longing for this? Or actually, if I step back, you know, if I were my own friend, what would I be telling myself? So really try to think about why you're remembering things in a certain way or with a certain filter. And then that might bring you back and go, actually, wait, that's not at all how it happened. And you might then have a more nuanced or more balanced memory.
So why would you be thinking something like that? Dumb it down for me, go one stage further. Why would, if you're doing that equation in your head, why would you do it?
Because I've told you to. So a therapist maybe told you to, or you heard this podcast and you're thinking, wow, maybe next time I'm in a crisis state and I'm you know, thinking about an old lover that I'm longing for. Actually, maybe I should stop for a second and go, okay, wait, why do I think this way? And then take it a step back.
Okay. But you could also do things like the example that I read is that you could stop eating ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Or sugar or something like that. You could get your... How do you do that?
So that's been lovingly referred to as the false memory diet. Again, Elizabeth Loftus, who I introduced earlier, so Elizabeth Loftus did this research on getting people to misremember having bad experiences with things like ice cream. So essentially, you would convince a participant that they got really nauseous, that they threw up violently into a toilet and it was all pink everywhere and it's a strawberry ice cream. And so the idea being that if you visualize this strong enough and complex enough, sort of multi-sense, really smell what it was like to be, you know, throwing up, that you then... next time you see strawberry ice cream, go, no, thank you. So, and it works. And so she found...
We can do this ourselves.
Yeah, you can.
We have the power.
It's essentially aversion therapy. It's essentially grossing yourself out about things so that you stop doing them. And it's something that we've done for a long time, but it's a different version of it.
You know, you get that memory, the one which grosses you out, as you say, but it keeps coming back every now and then. I have one about a skin thing that I have, and it comes... Why does that keep appearing back in my memory continually?
Intrusive thoughts. I mean, if you've thought about something a lot, or you have a fear about something, you're worried about a skin thing, for example, you might... you've probably strengthened that
memory.
I'll
tell you what it was. I was watching this TV show, and they were... it's not really a skin thing. They were skinning a... animal. It might have been a mink or a dog or something. No, it was a fox. That was it. And they pull the skin off and the animal's still alive and it runs off without its fur. And I'm thinking about it now. It's horrific. I cannot get that memory out of my mind. And every now and then I'll just be sitting there and it pops back in and I'm like, where's that come from? And then my day's ruined because I want to go home. This is horrific. It's such a horrible thing to watch a human do that to an animal that...
I mean, you could argue that that's essentially like a PTSD sign. I mean, these intrusive unwanted thoughts definitely happen, and they can happen because they're triggered. Let's say you have some sort of... Usually they're triggered in moments where we have similar kinds of emotions. So if you've ever noticed that if you're sad, suddenly all the times that you've been sad come flooding back, or you're embarrassed, all the other times you've been embarrassed before come flooding back. You're going, fuck you, brain. Why are you doing this to me? I need help, not to make it worse. And that's because that's how memory networks work. So when you activate this emotion, it's also activating other memories that are also linked with this emotion potentially, automatically.
Your memory's there for survival then, techniques.
I mean, you could say that about most things in...
But that's probably what is there, is it? There's a bit of instinct and a bit of memory.
I mean, memories are inherently useful in terms of remembering who hurt you, who didn't, who, you know, friend and foe. Is this poisonous? Is this not? So in that sense, it's useful. In terms of our autobiographical memory of, you know, I did this thing last summer, or I loved this person, even that's useful. You need to remember, you know, who you have children with. Otherwise, you might forget them.
So just to go back, I want to give up. Say I want to give up oranges. I just imagine myself, and this is a process over days, or can I do it in minutes, that I imagine the oranges and they're making me sick and they're making me... I like oranges, so I'm not going to do that.
Don't do that with oranges.
No,
it's healthy.
I love oranges. I'll do it with something I don't like. But how long could it take me to get that memory in?
I mean, it can go pretty fast. That being said, this isn't, as far as I know, a wildly practiced therapeutic technique.
Right.
It's just something we've done for funsies and experiments.
Okay. Are you a therapist, though?
I am still not a therapist.
I'll tell you what, though, that is great therapy, isn't it? If you could get... how much money would you make, Dr. Julia, if you could get all these people to just give up ice cream and sugar and everything else they want to eat? You'd make a fortune. Cigarettes, drugs, alcohol.
It also works the other way. So you can also make asparagus sexy, for example. There was a series of false memory experiments on asparagus. The asparagus industry apparently wasn't doing very well in the States. And so they said, Beth, can you help us? And she made essentially adverts and other things that were more appealing and increased people's desire to eat asparagus.
Nice.
So I think that's probably the better way around.
Your book is interesting. I recommend people read it. And there's one chapter which goes back to the crime stuff you were discussing earlier, Tookie Pulled My Pants Down. That chapter, which is quite a serious thing, your memory, when you come to ask about witnesses and also when you come to ask people involved in crime. We can't talk about the whole chapter, but can you summarize the sort of stuff you're talking about in that chapter?
Yeah, I mean, I build up from... the book is structured in a way that it starts off with these really tiny, everyday false memories. So, you know, forgetting...
Yeah, start with... Sorry to interrupt you, but the first one is people who think they remember stuff from their birth.
Yeah.
Is nonsense.
Yeah, nonsense. Yeah, 3.5 is the earliest you can remember stuff. Right. If you think you remember being born, it's a false memory. So it must be wrong.
And if you remember stuff... Like, I think I remember looking out of a pram, but that's probably a picture
I've seen. And if you're... the kind of person who's listening to this podcast who has a strong desire to tell me that I'm wrong because you have this anecdote, please don't. People love to write me and say, no, you're wrong because I have this memory. And then I go, that's the point. False memories feel like real memories and it's hard to let go of them. And so even when you're confronted with evidence from neuroscience that says this is absolutely impossible, people will cling to their memories and say, no, but I remember it so clearly.
I remember looking out of a pram.
Yeah, and no,
I
was... no, you don't.
I bloody do.
Stop right
and
there.
And I remember being picked up by someone I didn't want to be picked up and kissed by.
No, but it's probably a pretty easy thing to imagine.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. All right, so let's get back to that. We get back to keep all my parts down. So how the structure of the book, go on, start
the structure
with
small of the book.
Things.
Yeah, so it starts from small everyday things, talks a bit about the brain, but then skips really quickly into social sort of things. Do you remember being born? How do baby brains evolve? At what point can they remember? To things that we're all used to, sort of a story getting better every time it's told. And then I build up to this, the more severe impacts of misremembering. And that's where I end up with this chapter on a case where someone is accused of a crime, of impossible crimes, if you will, by a group of children, or actually a number of people are accused by a number of children. And it just, things get out of hand and parents get, it's part of the satanic panic, it's called, of the 80s and 90s, where people thought that children saying to social workers or other therapists who maybe overinterpreted cues about, you know, somebody wet the bed or somebody wets their pants, that must mean that something terrible has happened to them. Let's go digging for this memory. Let's interview these kids. And of course, peeing your pants is not an indicator that you've been abused. But if you take it as an indicator and you start asking suggestive or leading questions, kids might start to say, oh yeah, maybe that's something that happened. Maybe someone touched me inappropriately. And you can get into really sticky situations where it's really difficult to know whether something actually happened or whether kids or adults as well maybe are just following the lead and the assumptions of the interviewer.
People want to believe it. They want to believe their memories.
They want to believe their memories, and they want to believe kids. And it's important to believe victims, and it's important to give victims or perceived victims voices. But if you give it an uncritical voice, if you will, and you have stories of robots and things flying around rooms, and you go, oh, well, but maybe they just didn't know what that meant, or you didn't know what, you know, abuse was, and so they've interpreted as witches and things flying around, rather than saying, okay, well, things don't fly around, that's impossible. I think we can get into situations where people can be accused of crimes they didn't commit.
Okay, that is really complicated. We can't go into that in more detail, otherwise we'd be here all day, but it's well worth reading that. It's from Dr. Julia Shaw's book, The Memory Illusion. Let's just run across a couple of other things. Let's talk about sleep and dreams. Sleep is the downloading of information from the day. You need to do that.
It's sort of like the download. It's I call it the replay. Or it's essentially it's consolidation. So when you sleep, you set memories from the day into your brain in a more permanent way.
And dreams? Is that's the process happening?
Maybe. I mean, we're still trying to figure out exactly what dreams are, why we have them. Why do you vividly hallucinate for possibly a few hours every night? It doesn't really make any sense. But it might be because we're replaying the experiences that we had during the day. And in that process, it's triggering these networks that are associated, these memories, other memories that can get weird.
Could it be the warning signs for you? You lay in bed at night and your dreams come and it's your brain's desperately searching. You say you're going through a job promotion or something, or there's someone at work who's being horrible to you, and your brain's desperately searching for all the information to give it back to you in your dream to give you a warning about it. Could it be that? Is that far-fetched, Dr. Julia?
I don't think it's a warning. It might well be if you've been fearing or if you've been worrying about something all day and then you dream about it, that's not entirely surprising because you've just activated those parts of your brain and they're just still active. But yeah, I don't think your brain can tell the future or your dreams.
Okay. hypnotherapy, hypnosis. That was an interesting bit in your book, actually, because I'm on your mum's side on this, because you argue with your mum about this, don't you?
I do, yeah.
But I've watched stage hypnotherapists, mm-hmm. and those people are definitely under the... They've tried to do it with me, and I've never been hypnotized. But these people are under hypnosis. You're saying it doesn't exist.
Well, I think the comment is it's not a thing for hypnosis. But then I backtrack a bit, don't I? Because then I go through the research and I go, actually, well, what is hypnosis? What is it defined as? What are we talking about here? And we know that it is effective in, for example, surgery. That people can be that the kinds of people who can be hypnotized, which isn't everybody, but people who can be hypnotized, if they are hypnotized before surgery, can endure much more pain without anesthetics than people who are not hypnotized. So we know that it has some measurable effects on people. The question is, what is it? And I think that's the biggest question, is that there is this thing called sort of social influence that we know about. We know that some people are willing to give over essentially control over what they do and what they think and what they say to other people. But we don't really know exactly who those people are, except that we call them, quote, hypnotizable. And besides handing over this control, it doesn't seem to be a more sort of nefarious process where you're actually controlling people's minds.
I look at social media and I just think that all the time, that people so firmly sit on one side of a fence, say the Brexit argument or something. I'm like, hold on, there's a bit of grey here. But every, you know, they'll just follow someone because it's suggested that that is the route, and everyone trundles off down that route. We're like just sheep, aren't we, following all the time? But that's getting away from memory.
Social media memory is an interesting thing to talk about in general, because there's this whole perception that people's memory must be getting worse because we have social media.
Well, Google must be killing our memories, right? No. I don't have to remember anything now. I've got Google.
Again, a whole chapter in the book, because I was asked this question so many times. I'm like, I need to write about this. But Google isn't bad for our memories as a whole, for our brains, I don't think. But it does change the way we remember. And this is true for all social media. Is if you're recording things, what you're doing is you're not paying as much attention to them, because your brain goes, ah, I have this for later. I don't need to remember this. I have a picture of it, or I can Google it. But what we remember instead is we remember where information is kept rather than what the information is. And so even for Google, you need to know the right terms. You still need to know where to look. You still need to know what to look for. Mm. But you don't need to remember the exact dates of things, for example.
All right, let's just run through a couple of other things which interest me. Brainwashing. brainwashing by, I don't know, I was just discussing it there, politicians, religions, King Jong-un and King Jong-il, they made the whole of North Korea think they were immortal and stuff like that. Can you brainwash people's memories? Is that something you can do?
It depends on what you refer to when you're talking about brainwashing. Brainwashing is usually used in a political context. I usually like to refrain from calling my work brainwashing, because I'm not changing people's political views. I'm not trying to change sort of their whole worldview. There's no reason why you can't, however, distort people's worldviews. You can influence their perception. We know that. You can share, pictures of, say, really big crowds that maybe weren't so big, hypothetically. And that can influence how people remember the event. And certainly on a large scale, but even on a personal scale, you can influence how people think about the world.
Does subliminal learning change your memory?
No.
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 That doesn't work?
No.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Why is it banned then?
Good talk.
At least we got to the end of that quickly. It's still banned though, isn't it? Subliminal messages in advertising and stuff.
It's still banned.
Yeah, isn't it?
I don't know. Oh, is okay. It?
I don't know. I thought it was. I thought it was. I thought you had to. Anyway, let's move on.
I think you're not allowed to do product placement without... I think that might be... But that's right. Different. Product placements are sort of having a Coca-Cola can on a... I don't know, on a TV counter somewhere. It doesn't...
You can do
different.
That now. That is allowed now, as long as you... Yeah, anyway, let's go on to something else. Is it easier to remember anti-things that make us feel anxious or pro-things that make us feel good?
What do you mean?
Oh, that's a good question. Because you don't know the answer. So, anti-stuff. So, say, I don't know, let's just do an example. That politician's terrible, he'll kill you and he'll ruin your life. Or vote for this politician because he'll make your life happy and everything will be exciting. Is it easier to remember nice things, happy things, or is it easier to remember the anxious, horrible things?
It's easier to remember the horrible things.
Is it?
Hence remembering the skinned animal for you.
Yeah,
sorry
I can't,
to
thanks.
Bring that back.
it's a little face. You're welcome. It's this little face looking at me like, what have you done? What is going on here? Help.
No, negative things. I mean, things that threaten our existence is generally sort of the evolutionary psychology interpretation of that. Things that, you know, could kill you are going to be remembered better because, well, they're more important to be remembered.
Yeah, okay. All right. Photographic memories, is that a thing?
Nope.
I like these answers. Why not?
are you hoping for more?
Yeah, well, have you got an
I do a lot of myth busting in the book and in my work in general.
Yeah, read it in the book. That's the answer to that one. can we forget horrible things in our lives, can't we? We've sort of gone through that. How easy is it for us to create the false memories? We've discussed that. It can take minutes, can it, to do this? Is that what we're saying?
It can, yeah. I mean, in my research, I usually do it over a couple of weeks, but I also do more severe memories that I implant.
Okay. If we've got any students listening to this, what would your tips be for if you want to learn for exams? Do you know how to do that?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing to do is to think multisensory. So multisensory means trying to engage what you're hearing, what you're seeing, what you're thinking. And the idea is to make essentially big, juicy memory traces. So if you're trying to remember a fact, don't just repeat the fact over and over again. What you want to do is you want to engage with it in different ways. You want to think about it, maybe try to draw it, maybe try to think what it would smell like. And that seems sometimes like, how does a number smell? Even just the act of you trying to think what the number 2 smells like is going to make you remember it better.
You shouldn't have chosen that number. That was the wrong number to choose.
See, there we go. maybe some subconscious,
yeah,
stuff going
so.
On there. So we can picture what the number 2 smells like, but that's true for most things. And so things that initially don't have sort of anything that's linked to them inherently, you can quite easily jump to things. Number 3, number 4, number 5, you can equally think of things that those might associate with in your world. And the more information you put with it, the more multisensory stuff you pair, the more likely you are to remember it.
Okay, so if you were going to do your, I don't know, periodic table and you got all the chemicals out, but you were like going to smell an orange next to iron and an apple next to zinc, that would help, would it?
Not actually smelling it necessarily.
Oh,
but
just imagining
thinking
it.
About it. Yeah, and thinking about iron. So if you're trying to remember the like Fe for iron, try to think about the big letter F, a big letter E, maybe walking around it in a 3-dimensional space. Maybe they're doing something with iron. Maybe they're made of iron. And make it weird, because weirdness sticks.
How's your life? It must be quite strange, because the rest of us go, oh, I'm miserable. And then you go, well, I'm not actually miserable. It's my perception of what's going on. So you must go through life just kind of joyous, really. Do you? Do you have any problems?
I do. I mean, I do have deep existential angst. So there's that sort of the why are we here? And life is meaningless. But that's for another conversation. But no, in terms of memories, I do feel like it's freeing to not live in the past and to not give your memories too much weight and to sort of think, okay, no, I'm enjoying now.
So you are like Buddhism. It's like that, living in the present.
It's like that, but from a scientific foundation.
Yeah, but it's the same stuff.
It is the same stuff. And I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, it must be. And if you do come across something, do you ever go through depression or anything then? Or do you ever get sad?
I do get sad, but again, for different reasons, not because of my past, but because of the meaning of life. You know, small question.
Do you sit there pondering that a lot?
I sometimes like to call myself in the evening. This happens when I'm alone. I can't be alone very long. But when like someone's gone to sleep next to me and I'm still awake, oh, bad news. Right. And I sometimes call myself a burrito of sadness.
Oh,
I'm just like wrapped in my covers thinking about how we're all going to die.
They reckon they reckon the great mathematicians of this world, often they go mental at the end. And great scientist, you're going to be like that, aren't you? You're going to when you get into your old age, you're just going to be rocking, going, give me morphine.
I hope not.
Turn my brain off.
It does give you a sense of urgency to realize that we're not here forever, and it certainly for me, I consider it a huge motivating factor as well.
Have you come to any conclusions then about why we're here?
Nope. I think it's just to enjoy life, and we're just lucky that we are conscious, because a lot of things aren't in this world.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've got some questions for you that we ask all our guests to come on. I've sent them to you, so you know what I'm going to ask you, don't you?
I do.
So hopefully you've got some answers. Yeah. What advice were you given that has been invaluable to your life?
Follow your. This is so cliche.
Go on.
Follow your dreams and not the money. Do what you love. But I think it's true. I think that you do need to find your passion project and go with it.
Do you love your job?
I do. I love parts of my job more than others, but I think that's true for everybody. But I really love, again, sounds cliche, but I really love that moment when people look at me and go, I think about myself differently now because of this thing that you've shared with me.
Mm. Well, I think about you differently. I actually think you've got the key, and that I find that really, it's quite distracting, really, because I think you know too much.
The key to your brain, to people's
brains.
Yeah,
well, you know more than us. And it's like, you know, when you... I met a Buddhist monk recently, and everybody loved him because everyone just felt, you've got the key, we don't. You've got something we don't have. Mm. And I feel that you've got something we don't have that, you know, like, I could practice doing what you say, but you actually know how it works, right?
Well, but I mean, I dedicate my life to trying to communicate how it works so that you also have that key.
Thank you. All right. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that can help them?
That can help them? Don't rely on your memories. So if you...
Oh, no.
But this isn't... It's just a reality. I mean, you might not like that your positive and your negative memories could be false, but it's the truth. And so whenever there's something, especially something really important to you that you need to validate, that you need to say, did this actually happen? Seek independent evidence, because just thinking about it harder and just thinking, ooh, but I'm really confident in this, or ooh, I have so many details, or ooh, I have so many emotions here, doesn't necessarily mean that that memory is true. So what you're looking for is, you're looking for independence. Other people who you haven't talked to about the event, for example, ask them what their version is. Look for photos, look for social media things to say, did this actually happen? Because it's easy to be overconfident in our memories.
Do you find it hard knowing that most of your life is false?
I mean, saying most of my memories of my life are false is it's hard. It's impossible to quantify. And I think that's what's really important to remember, is it's impossible to know how many of your memories are accurate and in which ways they're accurate. And that's what's so insightful in a way.
I'll tell you something that's happened to me twice, which won't happen to a lot of people, right? Because I'm on TV, people watch me, recognize me, and then they'll send me pictures of me from the past.
Oh.
So I've had this happen twice. One when I was the picture was me producing an outside broadcast on Big Breakfast, where the presenter was Richard Orford. And for some, I don't know how they remember, but I'm in this picture. And they sent it to me, and I have no recollection of being in that place at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was, a guy came over from... he's a Kiwi, and he'd come over to England to live. And I just happened to travel with him for a few weeks in America in a camper van with him and an Aussie guy. And he took a picture, he'd taken some pictures, and he'd watched me on TV. And I suppose my name's quite memorable, Lovejoy, and gone, ah, okay. So he sent me a picture in. And I was like, I just don't remember being in that camper van with him. It was like, I just have no memory of it because it's gone. So this doesn't happen to most people because they don't get recognized on TV and then someone sends them a picture from their past.
But they do. There's this lovely feature in Facebook right now, Time Hop. Hop does exactly that to people. And it randomly throws pictures in your face and goes, and do you remember this wonderful moment? And sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, I don't know why you're showing this to me, Facebook algorithm. And sometimes it can be cruel. Sometimes it can be things that you're like, actually, I don't think that was as positive as, you know, or it's remembered less positively now than it was then.
But I've wrapped my brain to try and remember these things, and it's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone forever.
It's gone forever.
And the only way I remember it now is by looking at that picture and making it up again.
Yeah. Well, and that's always the trouble. And that's the back to being born or... childhood
life,
memories,
yeah.
Is that sometimes we just reconstruct.
I was
things.
In a pram, Dr. Julia. I was in a pram. Okay, so that's the advice you'd give them to not take their memories too seriously. Was that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, what mistakes do most people make? And this could be in your job.
In my job? What mistakes do people make? Again, I think the biggest one is that they are overconfident in the emotional aspect of their memory. So they assume that things like traumatic memories must be stuck there forever.
What about in your job, though? You've got lots of peers being rude about them. Are there some people who are really old school in the way they think about memories and and you lot are coming through going, nah, that's all wrong, what you're
talking
about.
It's a trap. This is a trap.
No, it's not a trap. It's totally a trap. I don't need to say anything, but is there an old way of looking at things that people
There
still
is an old way of
to?
Looking at things. I'm going to fall into your trap. I'm going to step right in. I am critical of sort of some of the original psychologists, including Freud.
She said Freud.
Oh my god. Oh, you can't even imagine the hate mail I receive from certain therapists. But I'm very skeptical of psychoanalysis, which is what Freud's taught, or the theories he came up with. And he has some notions around memory which are just not evidence-based. There's absolutely nothing to suggest that this is how memory works. Things like repression, something that we talk about a lot in pop culture. We talk about, oh, I must have repressed that. No, you probably didn't. You just didn't think about it for a while. Or you just, like when we use the term, I forgot that. It usually just means I didn't think about it for a while. Not I actually forgot it. Because you can actually forget things. And just because something's emotional or potentially traumatic doesn't mean it's there somewhere. It can also just be gone. And digging around and looking for those memories can be problematic.
Ah, so Freud could be doing more damage than good, is your theory.
Oh, yeah. And Freud has done a lot. I mean, he was huge for developing the field, of course. But in terms of the way that his techniques are practiced now, sometimes I think they do fracture families and they can really, hurt people.
That's the opinion of Dr. Julia Shaw, not the Do Love Joe podcast. let's distance ourselves from that hate. No, that's really fascinating, isn't it?
But it's important for people to know. Because people don't know that psychoanalysis is problematic. And they'll sign up. My mom signed up for a therapist recently. And I always go, what are you doing in this therapy? And then she's, oh, well, we're digging around in my childhood. I'm like, leave.
Really?
Get out now.
Run, flee to the hills. Any final question? Any life hacks?
Life hacks. I mean, if you want to remember stuff, multisensory is the way to go. The biggest life hack is, I think, just this advice of live in the moment and know how your memory works. Don't just use it, but actually learn how it works.
It seems all advice is live in the moment. It just seems everything is about living in the moment and not overthinking life.
Across disciplines.
Which you could take a leaf out of that book as well. Not overthinking how life works. How are you doing that, by the way? How are you trying to get to the bottom of what life's about?
Mostly just fear. just panic.
Panic, okay.
Yeah, late night panic.
All right, well, listen, thank you so much for coming on. Your book is called The Memory Illusion. It's by Dr. Julia Shaw. Where can people follow you on Twitter?
At Dr. Julia Shaw.
And Facebook?
No,
you're not on Facebook.
Please don't try that on Facebook.
Okay. Anything else? Anywhere else you are at?
Anywhere else? I mean, the book was translated into 14 languages.
Was it?
So if you don't speak English, it's probably possibly available in the language you do speak.
And how
better.
How do you know that it's been translated well?
I have no idea. The German version I did check. Oh. But apparently it's doing quite well in Japan.
Is it?
Which I heard today. And I have no way of knowing whether or not they captured the essence even of the book. There's a girl falling through water on the cover of it, which as far as I know, isn't what the book is about.
Yeah, I follow you on Twitter, and every front cover has been changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, they're all different.
Why is that?
No idea.
Do they have to clear it with you first?
No.
No.
They just do what they want.
It's a very good read. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Love, joy.
So that was Dr. Julia Shaw, Mark. What did you make of that?
My brain's broken.
I would just love...
That was so good, wasn't it?
I would love to sit with her. Was it too long, do you think?
No, it could have got... we need to find out, but I don't think so. I could have done 2 hours on that.
I would like to get her down the pub and sit for 2 or 3 hours just... just milling over the meaning of life and stuff.
Well, that's an invitation, Dr. Julia, if you're listening.
No, I just think it would be. I just think it's like I love that stuff. Yeah. I love it, and I do believe that some people have the key to certain things. You know, yeah. She's got the key to our memory, as in she knows more about it than we do. And I find that sort of stuff fascinating. Well, I hope you lot all found it fascinating as well, because it was long, but hopefully that's all right. I'd like you to let us know what you think about it. You can tweet us you can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy, or you can email us at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Make sure you subscribe. We'll be doing more of these, won't we, Mark? And make sure you rate us. That would be good. But we're going to be back on Monday.
Monday.
So it's just a one-off special. We'll be back Monday.
We'll do two this week, shall we?
Shall we?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, come on.
Oh, we're spoiling you, listeners. Two podcasts in a week. All right, we'll see you all Monday. Bye.
Bye.